If that's the case, then our direct democracy powers have been destroyed. It's that important.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. We've got an absolutely can't miss conversation with Susan Shelley coming up today. Susan Shelley is absolutely brilliant. I'm sure you know her well. She covers the detail of these stories in California like nobody else. And wait till you hear what they are up to in terms of trying to mess around yet again with our elections. It is absolutely stunning and shocking. And we got the details coming up. But I want to start with the big story, which was, of course, the one that broke over the weekend, which was this attack on Israel by Iran. The first time that Iran has attacked Israel directly. And I want to start by focusing on that word attack. So you look at the coverage of all of this, and what you're now hearing is that Israel should show restraint in terms of Iran responding to Israel's attack, that's the word they use, Israel's attack on what they call the Iranian embassy in Syria, okay? Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy, so Iran responds, and now Israel should show restraint, as if it's like 50-50, you know, tit for tat. Israel attacks the embassy, Iran strikes back. Take the win, as Biden apparently was saying to Netanyahu. That is completely wrong. It is a total distortion of what happened. That so-called attack by Israel on the Iranian embassy, first of all, it wasn't the embassy. It was an annex to the consulate. Let's just get that straight. What was going on inside there? It was Iranian military leaders plotting to attack Israel, not just to attack Israel, to continue attacking Israel, because Iran has been attacking Israel for months. Iran attacked Israel on October the 7th through Hamas, but Iran funded it and organized it. That's been well reported. There were meetings in the run-up to October the 7th, chaired by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. The meetings were held in Lebanon, apparently. So Iran started it with their attack on Israel, which was October the 7th through Hamas. And then Iran continued it since October the 7th. Iran has been attacking Israel non-stop through Hezbollah in the north of Israel. Every day, pretty much, sending rockets into Hezbollah. Thousands and thousands of Israelis have had to leave their homes because of the non-stop attacks on Israel from Iran through Hezbollah. So Iran's been attacking Israel all along. And that meeting that was being held in that annex to the consulate was planning yet more attacks on Israel by Iran. So this is not like Israel attacking Iran and Iran striking back and leave it at that. No, this was a defensive move by Israel to take out those people plotting to continue the attacks by Iran. So this whole language is just totally distorted. Let's just get that straight. And then the second part of this is this word restraint. Let's focus on that. It's been all over the commentary on this. Biden apparently urging restraint, the media, all the brainy columnists writing about Israel must show restraint. Don't they see the reason that we are in this mess is because of restraint, the restraint that Biden has been showing to Iran? That's what's been driving all of this. Another word for restraint in this context is appeasement. Ever since he got into the White House, Biden has been showing restraint with respect to Iran, appeasing them, because they have this ideology of appeasement. I've talked about this before. If you're nice to bad people, they'll be good. But actually, as we see all over the place, not just, by the way, in the Middle East, here at home as well, in terms of crime, if you're nice to bad people, they'll be good. No, the opposite happens. If you're nice to bad people, they get worse and their behavior gets worse. And that's what we've seen in the Middle East. The appeasement of Iran, the restraint that Biden has shown to Iran has emboldened them, and that is what led to what we've seen in the last few months. The only way to stop the carnage and the chaos and the mayhem and the death and the destruction is strength. We know that, to show deterrence, strong deterrence. And that's why it is so wrong to say that Israel should now just sit back and, quotes, take the win. What an offensive phrase, take the win. Hundreds and hundreds of rockets that could have caused so much death and destruction. Yes, defended against this time because of the excellent defenses of the Israelis supported by our forces and thankfully Jordan as well. That's all great. Take the win? What are you talking about? It's not a win. What the Iranians take from that approach is, oh, great. Well, nothing happens when we do this. We send a bunch of rockets, nothing happens. So let's do it again, is the obvious message that they would get. It's a green light for further attacks. That's why it's so incredibly important that Israel does not follow the advice of Biden and all these pundits and make it clear to Iran that there are consequences when they attack directly. We've got to be clear about all this. And there's one further thing I just want to say. When you look at the commentary around all of this and the campaigning and the activism and the young people particularly, all now basically siding with Iran against Israel. And these are the exact same people who, in other contexts, they're the ones that scream the loudest about our democracy, 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 and gender equality. And what are they doing now? Basically acting as propagandists for a brutal, authoritarian regime that persecutes women, that persecutes gay people against a democracy, Israel. I mean, it's just laughable. When I was getting politically active in the 80s and 90s, there was a huge thing that happened that really showed everyone, in particular people in the creative community and on the left and so on, what this awful Iranian militant regime, this imperialist regime that wants to spread its absolutely vile medieval interpretation, misinterpretation of Islam around the world and what lengths it will go to, was the fatwa that was issued against the author Salman Rushdie, a British author, very well known, read his books, he's a huge figure in the cultural life of the UK. And they said, no, he must die because of his book, The Satanic Verses. It came out when I was at college, I remember it. We talked about it. And they said, no, we don't like the book, he has to die. So Salman Rushdie had to spend decades in hiding. Slowly, he thought, well, maybe, you know, it's safe to come out now, started making more appearances. And then we had that absolutely awful attack on him not that long ago. Someone stabbed him when he's on stage at a literary festival here in America. And now he's coming out again and he's out engaging in the public conversation once more. And we're thankful that he's okay. Obviously, he's been badly injured, but he's okay. But it reminds us who this regime really is. And it's just, I guess, something that this next generation of activists just isn't aware of, but they should be aware. And they should see the Iranian regime clearly for who they are, a bunch of murderous terrorists, ideologues, imperialists who persecute women, who persecute gay people, one of the worst regimes on the planet. They don't represent the people of Iran. The people of Iran want to get rid of this appalling regime. So when you're siding with Iran and making Iran's points and justifying what they do, you're siding with this absolutely despicable regime against the Iranian people and against civilized values everywhere. All right, let's have a policy conversation now. The policy that's had the biggest effect in all sorts of ways, so many people over years now, is inflation, of course. And what really is unbelievable is when you see inflation data come out, as we saw recently, ticking up again after they told us that it had been vanquished and Biden's done such a brilliant job of controlling inflation. It's just amazing to hear the talking points from the Democratic side, from Biden and the surrogates and so on, and echoed in many cases by the media. You say, well, it's so weird that people are still concerned about inflation and don't give Biden good marks for the economy. And he's like massively behind Trump when it comes to who's best to handle the economy because things are going so well. And really, inflation's right down now. And it was like 10% and now it's right down and so on. And they go on and on, sort of baffled at why people aren't more grateful to them over their economic record. And they even say things like, well, it was a nightmare under Trump and we got it all down and haven't we done a brilliant job? Well, first of all, that's just literally not true. It was 1.4% when Biden took over. And then it went massively up. And yes, it's down again a bit, but it's now, you know, just over 3%. But look at what happened during that period. You had years where inflation and even within the overall headline number, the prices of things that people really you know, see and affect them in their daily life, whether that's food and gas and housing costs and all these things escalating much faster than some of the other prices, really hurt people up and down the income scale, but of course, particularly on the lower end of the income scale, and wages were not going up nearly as much. And so when you hear the White House now, they make these points, I mean, just in response to last week's bad number on inflation, they're saying, well, it's still, you know, Biden put out in a statement, wages are now rising faster than prices. This is absolutely amazing. So that is technically true, but the Wall Street Journal looked at the numbers. So even if you take the last year, okay, the last 2 months, it's not true. So in the last 2 months, inflation has been going up faster than prices. So Biden's claim is wrong on that. But if you take the last year, to be fair, it is true that wages are rising faster than prices. But here's the number. I'm just quoting now from the Wall Street Journal editorial. The real average hourly wage in constant dollars was $11.11 in March, up from $11.04 a year earlier. So the sum total of how fast wages have risen compared to inflation in the last year. This is their big claim. Wages are now rising faster than prices. That's like the central, you know, talking point that they put. Yeah, it's true by 7 cents. 7 cents in the last year. And by the way, if you look at the overall record since Biden took office, as they point out, it's actually lower. Earnings are lower and down after inflation by 2.54%. So people can see that and they see what's been going on. And so it's just so funny that they try and kind of claim that things are going well. And the other part of this story that we have to say, the other kind of policy component of this that's very important to bear in mind and is often overlooked, is that if you just talk about inflation coming down, even though it hasn't come down as much as they'd like to claim, but that's just half the story. Because what is the policy mechanism that they use to bring inflation down, the one that we always use to bring inflation down? Interest rates. The reason that inflation has come down to the extent that it has is because of high interest rates. And that produces its own cost and its own impact on things like mortgage rates. So it's like a double whammy. First, they hit you with higher prices, and then they hit you with higher interest rates. And so that's why when they say, oh, everything's great and Bidenomics and we've done a really good job and our economic policies are marvelous, and people just look at them like, what planet are you on? It's a disaster economically, and it's all caused by their policies. All right, joining us for California Corner today, our friend Susan Shelley. By the way, if you don't follow Susan Shelley on X, I'm just learning to say X instead of Twitter, then you're really missing out, because it's absolutely brilliant commentary, so forensic and detailed. She's all over the big stories and the small ones and the ones that make a difference. And there was something I saw this week that was so perfect. Susan, it was your post about the latest on water. Now, we know water's a disaster in California. They haven't invested in water storage, so we have this ridiculous situation every year when we get all the rain and it's flushed out to the ocean. We've talked about that before. But there was a particular thing that struck you, and the way you put it was so perfect. So I'm just going to hand it over to you. This was the Southern California Municipal Water Board, I think. Is that the name?
It's the Metropolitan Water District.
Metropolitan Water District, yes. Right. Very, very big. Right. They do water. Is it 26 million people, something like that?
Six counties. 26
right.
Member agencies.
26 member agencies. I knew that. It's a lot of people in Southern California. And tell us what they just announced.
Well, they just announced their 2-year budget, and they decided they would raise rates and they will raise property taxes. And everyone sort of looked at that and said, how can the Metropolitan Water District raise property taxes? And so the answer is, maybe they can't, but here's what they're thinking they can do. When Prop 13 passed in 1978, it had an exclusion. There's an override for previously voter-approved bonds. But this was in 1960. This was before Kennedy was elected. This was 1960. The voters approved bonds to build the State Water Project. The State Water Project is long since finished, but they have interpreted this provision to say that they can continue to raise property taxes to operate the system. And then they define operating the system very broadly. And what they keep trying to do, and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is watching this like a hawk, what they keep trying to do is build new things and call it part of the voter-approved state water project, like the Delta Tunnels, like a giant recycling project. This sort of thing is a new project. We don't even know what it's going to cost. And they're trying to say the voters approved it in 1960, and therefore they can override Prop 13 and raise your property taxes. But in this budget, what they said is that we don't want to raise rates too much, so we're going to raise property taxes and rates, and we've got four different alternatives that we're going to look at, and then they approved one of them. They're doubling the property tax rate. They just came up with this number. And the law says they can only raise property taxes if it's essential and necessary to the fiscal stability of the system, if it's necessary to pay the state water contracts. This is not something that they just have an option to do, but they did. And so we'll see how that plays out.
Brilliant. Thank you for explaining that. And then the other thing that was so fantastic is that when you picked apart their own announcement in terms of how they justify all this. And it's just so hilarious because it's completely incoherent. I think I'm quoting you now. You say, they told us to use less water. And so they're raising rates because they're selling less water. And they're raising rates because of the drought, but also because there's too much rain.
That's exactly what they said. You cannot make this up. The Marx brothers would have to write this material. What they said is, we're selling less water, so we can't pay the expenses of operating. And because the reason we're selling less water is first the drought and then the rain. So there's just no pleasing these people. They just want to raise your rates. And they know they can't raise the rates too much because people can't pay it. You already have a situation where there's a tremendous number of people in debt over water and electricity bills. They can't pay it. And you've got people in six counties. Metropolitan Water District is Los Angeles, Orange County, Riverside, San Bernardino, San Diego, and Ventura. And they're raising essentially wholesale water rates, and then DWP and the other water agencies will raise rates as a result of that.
So DWP, is that the subsidiary one?
Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, is a customer of Metropolitan.
I mean,
when
you list all those counties, I mean, you know, earlier I muddled up my numbers and I remember the number 26, and it's 26 subsidiary districts. Mm-hmm. I said 26 million people. Probably is close to 26 million people. I mean, the majority of the population of the state you'll find in those counties. That's
yes,
for
I
sure.
Think so. Mm-hmm.
I know that. When we've talked in the past about water storage and this scandal where they're just, you know, letting all this water go to waste that we get in the rains that are coming, and we've seen a lot in the last couple of years in particular, we bring up the most recent water bond that was passed. Was this $8 billion that was passed in 2014? Is that right? And the argument there is that nothing's been done, even with that we've already approved.
Right. I think there was $2.3 billion, if memory serves, that was specifically for water storage. But here's what they did in the wording of it. They said the water storage projects will not get the funding unless they can show public benefits. And the public benefits were defined as helping wildlife, helping emergency services, all these different things, helping jet skiers, recreation. One of the things that was not listed as a public benefit is providing water. It's insane. It's insane. And then they had this complicated funding mechanism where the local agency has to pay, they have to raise their own money to match the state funding from the bond, with the result that everybody had to go out and do these environmental impact reports and show that they could raise the money. And since 2014, we've built none of them. I don't think one of them's even been started. And we've lost all this water to the ocean that we should have been
saving. Every year. And it keeps going, and we see all this rain, and then they go on about the rain being too much, but we're not using it. And then they say there's a drought. I mean, and then they put the rates up. I mean, it's just utterly. I mean, it's not. It's.
And then they blame climate change.
Climate change. Of course, everything climate change. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you think that, and people, because they don't dig beneath the surface like you do, they're going to buy that. Oh yeah, climate change. Yeah, sure, things are getting worse, and so of course the rates are going. But it's just so offensive. to the you know, they treat the taxpayer with complete contempt. Mm-hmm. That's really what it is, and this is just yet another example of how in the government, so, you know, agencies, service, the entire, you know, state government in California is just sort of completely, I don't want to say incompetent, because it's not just, there's an aspect, I mean, there's an element of incompetence, but this is really willful, isn't it? It's, yes, like it they, is. This is on purpose.
Yes. What they want to do is they want to build big things, and they want to give jobs to the unions that support the politicians. And in order to build big things, they need a lot of money. So they either want bonds, or they want tax increases, or they want rate increases. And of course, all three of those things are paid by the same people out of the same pocket. And I've heard them argue this before. Oh, don't worry, Susan. It's not going to be paid by the taxpayers. It's going to be paid by the ratepayers. They're the same people.
Same people.
I know. It's very frustrating when you see the water rates and the electricity rates going up. And then they want to raise the taxes too, so they don't have to raise the rates too much. Well, what are they saying there? They're saying property owners should pay more than people who are not property owners. But property owners are struggling too. Everybody's struggling. And here's the really sad part. In the 1930s, the federal government built they built a water project on the Delta. And in the 1960s, the state built a water project on the Delta. Giant pumps to move the rain is what they called it when they were working on it. We're going to move the rain south. We have throttled the pumps because of the Endangered Species Act, the state and federal Endangered Species Act. People have come in and filed lawsuits over tiny little fish, which are not being protected anyway. They're not doing well even with throttling the pumps. Some of this, I think, is just about stopping growth and hating Southern California. But whatever the reason, they have throttled the pumps down from what it was in the 1980s, for example. And so they're saying, well, you have to drink toilet water in Southern California. We can only survive if we recycle water at tremendous expense to build these new facilities. But they don't want to build desalination facilities. They've kiboshed some of those plans. What do they want to do? The most expensive and disgusting things they can think of to just make people feel bad about living.
Exactly. And at the same time, they're removing dams, right? Mm-hmm. That's another thing they're doing in the northern part of the state. You know, we had a candidate on who's running for Congress up there explaining that. And so that's getting rid of the water infrastructure and energy infrastructure we have, which is ridiculous. When you say, let's go back to your point about they want to build big things. I mean, just to be clear about some of those, do they want to build the right big things? Because we've been saying we need more water storage, right? So we want some things to be built. Are they building, or are they intending to build the right things?
No, they're not. They want to build water recycling plants, and they don't want to build desalination, and they don't want to build water storage, and they don't want abundance, and they don't want lower rates.
They want
higher salaries, more hiring, more construction jobs for their union supporters. And they don't care how much it costs. Lately, though, there's been some pushback. You know, we all just saw what happened with Proposition 1, where the governor spent $20 million to pass it, the opponents spent zero, and they were chasing down ballots that had flawed signatures to get someone to sign a form at the last second, 2 weeks after the election, to try and get that across the finish line, and just barely did. People are not voting for big spending projects. They're not voting for tax increases. The voters really have spoken, I think, through the polls and through the ballot box to say we're at the limit, no more.
But it's really interesting, actually, if you look at that, you know, the specifics of this, there's a clear connection to their approach to everything, which is it's all so ideological. It's not practical. It's not common sense. It's not saying, right, we're a state now of whatever it is, nearly 40 million people. We got the infrastructure from, you know, half a century ago when the population was half that. We need to do something about that. We need more water storage. We need more energy. We need to do all these things so we can have abundance and not have this sort of anti-growth mindset. So let's build what makes sense. They're not saying that. Right. It's ideological. So when it comes to energy, it's this obsession with windmills and solar because of climate, whatever. But even if you go with them on climate and say, yes, we agree, we want to limit carbon emissions, then you would say, right, let's have nuclear, right, which is more reliable and is carbon free. But they're just not interested. They completely rule it out.
No, they want scarcity.
And the same with this water. So like some kinds of, you know, dealing with water, you know, so apparently, you know, recycling that, you know, that's okay. But storage, not okay.
Right.
And it just doesn't make sense. It's totally ideological.
It is. And they're also talking about conservation and demand management, which is another way of saying they're going to raise rates for high usage.
That's exactly what they say. We use less.
Use
and then
less,
they turn
around
and say, oh, we're selling less, so the rates have to go up.
It's so perverse. And, you know, it's really very corrosive in our society to do this, because when you tell people they can't have electricity and water, and then you have an open border and unlimited immigration, and you're using government resources to provide benefits to people who are here illegally, do you think people aren't going to be upset that you're telling them they can't use water and then you're trying to double the population through illegal immigration? People are angry, and that's corrosive. Yeah. And it isn't necessary. We could certainly have abundance. We could certainly build the right kind of infrastructure. We could spend our money more wisely. We could stop trying to model good climate behavior for China, which is not really working very well. And we could build things with our money that are useful for us.
Exactly. And I would say that's the California way, right? That's what it's about in California. It's growth and abundance and let's be the best place in the world and have the best of everything, right? That's what California, I think, should be.
Yes.
Just one last point before we leave this, because there's a big aspect of the water issue that we must always remember, which is our farmers. You know, I'm spending more and more time in Fresno and the Central Valley. I mean, they're absolutely being treated like dirt by the state water agencies and the local ones. And there's this one thing we should mention, which is SGMA, is the acronym, the State Groundwater Management Agency, or I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, everything about it is outrageous, not least the bureaucracy of it. So it sets up this bureaucracy where you have like more than 500 little areas, and each one of them has to have a sustainable groundwater plan and go through this bureaucracy in the process, whatever. What's the end result? Not enough water for one of our great industries, agriculture, where we export to the whole world. Like we produce 80% of the world's almonds, 70% of the world's pistachios. It's an amazing industry that we should be boosting and supporting. What are they doing? Cutting the water. So one consequence, I just heard this the last time I was there, 1 million acres being taken out of production just as a direct result of this water policy. So they're actually actively crushing an industry that's one of our world-beating industries. It's completely ridiculous.
It's very intentional. It makes you think that someone wants to buy that land for solar farms or something else, and they're driving down the value of the agricultural land. It's very evil. You know, it comes back to bite them sometimes. The state wants to build this giant overpriced delta tunnel system, which moves water under the delta. So it doesn't move through the delta, so it doesn't hurt the fish or whatever it is they're concerned about. So they want to build this giant tunnel system, but they're finding that the water districts are saying, well, we're not going to pay for that because you're not going to give us the water. And they don't trust anything about the promises that come out of Sacramento. And so, you know, you reap what you sow, so to speak.
Yes, and then but the farmers can't because they're not giving them enough water.
Exactly.
It's outrageous. I mean, yet another example of how we just need a complete overhaul of the way we do things in California. There's not a single issue that's being managed properly. It's all this far left ideology, and it's got to change, really. One more story before we go, Susan. This was, again, one of these ones where, thank goodness you're there, kind of keeping an eye on what they're up to.
Senate Bill 1441, it's going to change the law so that if the registrar of voters in your county throws out legitimate signatures on a petition, an initiative, a referendum, a recall petition, you go out and collect signatures, you get enough, you submit them, they go through them, and they throw out legitimate signatures. Right now, the law is you have the right as a proponent to go into the county offices and look at those signatures and the reason for rejection. Sacramento's trying to take that away. They're trying to change the law with SB 1441 so that you only have 60 days, which means the county can stonewall and you'll never get it done. And they want you to pay for it in advance. Right now, there's no charge. It's on the county. If they throw out signatures, you as the proponent can go see them. They have to show them to you. Now they want you to pay for it as if it's a recount. It could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And even if you come up with the money, it cuts off after 60 days. And if they don't have time to pull everything up on their screens, they don't have enough staff, they don't have whatever, They're not obligated to help you verify those signatures were thrown out correctly, which means they can do whatever they want and you can do nothing about it. This bill has to be stopped.
So basically, so one person and one office can directly intervene to throw out signatures if they want to reduce the number and stop something from qualifying. And then you're the person behind the campaign. And previously you could say, okay, I want to take a look at these signatures you've thrown out. You could do that and they have to pay. Now you have to pay for it in advance and there's a cutoff. So they can just, this is really bad.
This is really bad. This is based on what just happened in Los Angeles with the George Gascon recall effort. They submitted enough signatures. The county threw out 195,000 of them. The committee said, we want to see. They went in and looked. The county said, this is Registrar of Voters Dean Logan, well, we'll only let you come in Tuesday through Thursday, and you can only bring 14 people, and you can only have so many workstations to see these scans. It was so slow that they went to court. The committee went to court, and a judge agreed with them and ordered the registrar to make more resources available so they could get this done in a timely fashion. And the registrar appealed that decision and delayed it further, ran out the clock with repeated delaying tactics. They were never able to get through all the signatures. They got through about 100,000 of them. And then they went back to court with a lawsuit and they said, well, we have shown that we had enough to qualify. And they ran out the clock again. And now we're coming up on the November election. And so the case is going away. It's going to be settled and they're going to get rid of it.
Who are these registrars? Are they appointed? You know, what kind of office is that?
The Registrar of Voters County Clerk in Los Angeles County is appointed by the Board of Supervisors. I'm not sure if there are any counties in which they're elected. I think they're appointed everywhere by the Board of Supervisors. But they are the people who are responsible. It's a little different in every county, but they're the people who are responsible for election procedures, running elections, registering voters, verifying signatures on petitions, counting votes, all of that stuff.
It's just yet another example where you could say, fine, we assume that, you know, they're independent and they do their job professionally and that's what they want to do. Okay, fine. But you saw in LA that that wasn't the case. This guy actively intervened in order to protect George Gascon. There's no other way of describing what happened.
Certainly.
And so you say, well, if it can happen in Los Angeles County, it theoretically could happen in any county. You don't want to assume the worst, but there's one very clear example. So surely you would be trying to shore up the system and give people confidence that it works properly and protect against kind of political interference like this. Instead, they're going in the other direction and making it easier for, let's say, a rogue official to tip an election in the direction that they want.
You know, there are initiatives and referendum, and referenda is the plural, and recall petitions all over the state, local officials,
yes, all
local
the time.
Measures. It's not just the statewide thing like recalling the governor. It can be anywhere. It can be a district attorney. And if the people who are in the office, who are political people, they're political appointees or they're elected, if the people in the office have the power to put a thumb on the scale and determine which signatures will be counted and which ones will be tossed in an improper way, and no one can go in and review that because it's $400,000 in front and it's only 60 days, so they've completely eliminated the ability to verify. If that's the case, then our direct democracy powers have been destroyed. It's that important. So SB 1441, Senate Bill 1441, it's going to be heard in the Senate Constitutional Amendments Committee, Elections and Constitutional Amendments Committee, I believe on Tuesday of this week. But it has to pass in the Senate, and then it has to go to the Assembly, and then it has to be signed by the governor. And we can stop it at any of those points. So call your representatives. Look them up at findyourrep.legislature.ca.gov.
Exactly. If they don't know that we're keeping an eye on it and making a fuss about it, then these things are just going to sail through. Susan, brilliant. Brilliant work. Really, really appreciate it on both of those incredibly important stories. So illuminating. You're the one watching everything like a hawk. Hark. I got to say hark. If I say hawk in an English accent, no one knows what I'm talking about. I learned that when I was describing the threats to our chickens in our backyard. And I said, oh, it's a hawk. And then someone looked at me blankly. A hawk. You, Susan Shelley, are watching them like a hawk.
Well, I'm
appreciate
trying
it.
To.
Thank you, Susan. See you soon.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, so I just have to get this off my chest, this story this week about NPR. Have you seen the story? Absolutely brilliant. So a senior editor at NPR wrote an article for Barry Weiss's The Free Press, where he just laid into the culture at NPR and basically said that they've morphed from being a bunch of people who are curious and, you know, kind of left-leaning, but, you know, curious and interested in the world, to an absolutely, you know, clearly left-leaning propagandist outfit where they're scoldy and judgmental and carry a particular worldview. And then the NPR people react in horror and say, oh my God, this is, how can this person say this? He's now been suspended. But the hilarious thing about this is the response from NPR. And I actually have something, I have some pretty good knowledge about this. Because you believe it or not, I actually listen to NPR every single day. I have NPR on in the radio in our kitchen when I'm sort of running around in the morning, getting the kids breakfast and getting ready to take them to school. We got NPR on. And why do I do that? Because I think it's really important to have a balanced media diet, right? We get the Wall Street Journal delivered to our house and we get the New York Times, and I like to read everything. I watch Fox, I watch NBC, MSNBC and CNN. You know, I want to see what people are saying. I think that is healthy. So I listen to NPR every single day, unlike probably a lot of the people who are commenting on it. And I can tell you for absolute certainty, of course, it's biased to the left. I mean, it reeks. It absolutely reeks of the kind of left-leaning establishment groupthink. You hear it in every interview, you hear it in their choice of stories to cover, you hear it in the scripts that they read out. It's just completely obvious to anyone who listens to NPR for like 5 minutes that it's on the left. But you know what's really amazing is I actually think that the people who work at NPR and have reacted with such outrage to this colleague of theirs who's just dared to point out the truth, in the hope that it might change the culture, and they're all reacting in horror. Why? Because I think that they're so sanctimonious, they're so smug, so kind of lacking in self-awareness, and so hilariously out of touch with regular mainstream America. I think these people at NPR, they probably sincerely believe that they're not biased. They really do think that, which is the funniest part of this whole story. All right, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you've checked out Big Ideas Book Club, the show that we started recently. They're just really great conversations. I'm enjoying them so much. Just longer conversations, as the name suggests, about a big idea. And the one that's out this week, I think you will really enjoy, is with Brad Wilcox. You may have come across his work. I featured him on my Fox show. He's got an incredibly important argument about the importance of marriage in our society. And he goes through all the trends of what's happening to marriage and why it matters and what we can do to really make sure that this incredibly important institution in our society flourishes in the years ahead. Brad Wilcox is our guest this week. And next week, we'll be welcoming Benji Bakker, who's got a really interesting book about why conservatives should get involved in the fight to protect our environment, but not with the crazy far-left ideology that we're seeing around the whole climate change conversation. So that's a really great conversation I'm looking forward to as well on Big Ideas Book Club. And of course, make sure you follow us here for The Steve Hilton Show on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Tell everyone about the show. We love having you with us, and we'll see you back here next week.